Introduction. The Principles of Basic Life Support, or BLS, were introduced in 1960. Since then, the specific techniques for the management of cardiac arrest and the delivery of emergency and cardiac care have been reviewed and revised every 5 to 6 years. The goal is to produce the best recommendations possible given the available scientific evidence. The updated guidelines are published in peer-reviewed journals, circulation in the United States, and resuscitation in Europe. The most recent review was conducted by the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation, or ILCOR. This revision occurred as a result of a rigorous and systematic review of the newest scientific evidence surrounding the treatment of cardiac arrest and the provision of emergency and cardiac care, using validated, transparent, and scientifically rigorous methodology to produce the best recommendations possible given the available evidence. This chapter begins with a definition and general discussion of BLS. It then reviews methods for opening and maintaining a patent or open airway, providing artificial ventilation to a person who is not breathing, providing artificial circulation to a person with no pulse, and removing a foreign body airway obstruction. Each of these topics is followed by a review of the changes in technique that are necessary to treat infants and children. Chapter 2, Workplace Safety and Wellness, discusses the methods of preventing the transmission of infectious diseases during cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR. Chapter 6, The Human Body, discusses the anatomy and physiology of the respiratory and cardiovascular systems. Chapter 41, The Team Approach to Healthcare, discusses how to work as an effective team in the healthcare setting. During any emergency, working as a team is critical to give the patient the best chance for a successful outcome. Elements of BLS. Basic life support, or BLS, is non-invasive emergency life-saving care that is used to treat medical conditions, including airway obstruction, respiratory arrest, and cardiac arrest. BLS follows a specific sequence for adults and for infants and children. This care focuses on the ABCs: airway, obstruction, breathing, respiratory arrest, and circulation, cardiac arrest, or severe bleeding. If the patient is in cardiac arrest, then a CAB sequence, that is, compressions, airway, and breathing, is used because chest compressions are essential and must be started as quickly as possible. Ideally, only seconds should pass between the time you recognize that a patient needs BLS and the start of treatment. Remember, brain cells die every second they are deprived of oxygen. Permanent brain damage is possible after only 4 to 6 minutes without oxygen. If a patient is not breathing adequately or at all, then you may be able to restore normal breathing by simply opening the airway. However, if the patient has no pulse, then you must combine artificial ventilation with artificial circulation, that is, chest compressions. If breathing stops before the heart stops, then the patient may have enough oxygen in the lungs to stay alive for several minutes. But when cardiac arrest occurs, the heart and brain stop receiving oxygen immediately. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, is used to establish circulation and artificial ventilation in a patient who is not breathing and has no pulse. The steps for CPR include the following. 1. First, restore circulation by performing chest compressions to circulate blood to the vital organs of the body. 2. Next, perform 30 high-quality compressions to a depth of 2 inches to 2.4 inches, or 5 centimeters to 6 centimeters in an adult at the rate of 100 to 120 per minute. Next, open the airway with the jaw thrust or head tilt chin lift maneuver. 3. Last, restore breathing by providing rescue breaths via mouth-to-mask ventilation or a bag valve mask or BVM. Administer 2 breaths, each over 1 second, while visualizing for chest rise. The goal of CPR is to help restore spontaneous breathing and circulation. However, defibrillation and advanced interventions, that is, medication therapy, are often necessary to achieve this outcome. For CPR to be effective, you must be able to quickly identify a patient who is in respiratory and/or cardiac arrest and immediately begin BLS measures. BLS differs from advanced life support, or ALS, which involves advanced life-saving procedures, such as cardiac monitoring, administration of intravenous or IV fluids and medications, and the use of advanced airway adjuncts. However, when done correctly, BLS care can maintain life for a short time until ALS measures can be started. In some cases, such as choking, near drowning, or lightning injuries, early BLS measures may be all that is needed to restore a patient's pulse and breathing. Of course, these patients still require transport to the emergency department or ED for evaluation. The BLS measures are only as effective as the person who is performing them. Your skills may be good immediately after training, but as time goes on, skills will deteriorate unless you practice them regularly. To survive cardiac arrest, effective CPR at an adequate rate and depth with minimal interruptions is essential until defibrillation can be administered. Therefore, the BLS care you provide as an EMT is an extremely critical factor in the patient's chance for survival. The components of CPR. According to the American Heart Association, or AHA, 88% of sudden cardiac arrests occur in the home. Few patients who experience cardiac arrest in the pre-hospital environment survive unless a rapid sequence of events takes place. The AHA has determined an ideal sequence of events, termed the chain of survival, that if taken can improve the chance of successful resuscitation of a patient who experiences sudden cardiac arrest. A successful resuscitation is defined not only by the return of spontaneous circulation, or ROSC, but also the survival of the patient to hospital discharge. The five links in the chain of survival are as follows. 1. Recognition and activation of the emergency response system. The first step in the chain of survival requires public education and awareness. Laypeople must learn to recognize the early warning signs of a cardiac emergency and immediately activate EMS by calling 911. This step ensures that emergency responders are dispatched to the scene quickly, thus allowing the other links of the chain to be more effective. In modern EMS systems, the 911 dispatcher can provide pre-arrival instructions and direct the caller to provide CPR if needed. 2. Immediate, high-quality CPR. The initiation of immediate CPR by a bystander is essential for successful resuscitation of a person in cardiac arrest. CPR will keep blood, and therefore oxygen, flowing to the vital organs to keep blood, and therefore oxygen, flowing to the vital organs to keep the patient alive until the other components of the chain are available. The more people trained in CPR in the community, the better the chances of CPR being administered quickly to a person in cardiac arrest. Immediate, high-quality CPR markedly increases the patient's chance of survival, whereas a delay in CPR leads to poor patient outcomes. The lay public, as well as emergency responders, should all be trained in CPR. Unfortunately, many bystanders are hesitant to perform CPR on a stranger for fear of contracting a disease from mouth-to-mouth breathing or out of fear of liability, a perception that bystander CPR involves both mouth-to-mouth breathing and chest compressions persists. Laypeople should be educated in performing hands-only CPR. For chest compressions to be most effective, they must be given hard and fast. The AHA recommends that compressions be started as quickly as possible after onset of cardiac arrest. Compression should be between 2 and 2.4 inches in depth, or 5 to 6 centimeters, and given at a rate of 100 to 120 per minute. The chest should completely recoil between each compression to maximize blood return to the heart. The rescuer should never lean on the chest between compressions. Interruptions between compressions for any reason should be minimized. 3. Rapid defibrillation. Provided that immediate high-quality CPR with minimal interruption is performed, early defibrillation offers the best opportunity to achieve a successful patient outcome. Automated external defibrillators, or AEDs, have become readily available in many schools, fitness clubs, concert venues, sports arenas, government buildings, and other mass gathering places. The simple design of the AED makes it easy for emergency medical providers and laypeople to use with very little training. 4. Basic and advanced emergency medical services. This link in the chain describes care provided by EMTs and ALS providers before the patient arrives at the ED. Such care includes continuing high-quality CPR, basic airway management, that is, oral airway insertion, BVM ventilation, advanced airway management, that is, endotracheal ET intubation or use of supraglottic airway devices, manual defibrillation, vascular access, transcutaneous pacing, and administration of medications. In addition to the care provided in the pre-hospital setting, be familiar with the cardiac resuscitation centers in your service area. Your agency should implement a process to ensure early notification and transport to the appropriate receiving facility. Advanced life support and post-arrest care. After your team delivers the patient to the ED, further cardiopulmonary and neurologic support is provided to improve the patient's recovery when indicated. This support can include additional medication therapy to support blood pressure, targeted temperature management, that is, therapeutic hypothermia, maintenance of blood glucose levels, cardiac catheterization and electroencephalogram to detect seizure activity, and admission to the intensive care unit for critical care management. If any of the links in the chain is not maintained, then the patient is more likely to die. For example, few patients survive cardiac arrest if CPR is not administered within the first few minutes. Likewise, if the time from cardiac arrest to defibrillation is more than 10 minutes, the chance of survival is minimal. The patient's best chance of survival occurs when all the links in the chain are continuously maintained. Assessing the need for BLS. As always, begin by surveying the scene. Is the scene safe? How many patients are present? What is your initial impression of the patients? Are bystanders present who may have additional information? What is the mechanism of injury or nature of illness? Do you suspect trauma? If you were dispatched to the scene, then does the dispatch information match what you see? Because of the urgent need to start CPR in a pulseless, non-breathing patient, you must complete a primary assessment as soon as possible and begin CPR, starting with chest compressions. The first step is to determine unresponsiveness. Gently tap the patient on the shoulder and shout, "Are you okay?" Clearly, a patient who is responsive does not need CPR. A person who is unresponsive may or may not need CPR. Continue your assessment by simultaneously checking for breathing and a pulse. This step should take no more than 10 seconds. If the patient is in cardiac arrest, then begin CPR immediately. In some EMS services, EMTs respond in squad units before the ambulance. If this is the case in your area, then update the responding crew via two-way radio if possible. In other cases, you may encounter a cardiac arrest patient while off-duty. If you are alone and off-duty, use your mobile phone to call 911. Recall from Chapter 3, Medical, Legal, and Ethical Issues, that you must be familiar with the laws and policies that apply in your service area regarding your duty to act. If you are alone and do not have a mobile phone, then leave the patient to call 911 and then return to begin CPR. If you choose to intervene while off-duty, then you must continue to provide competent care until an equal or higher medical authority assumes care of the patient. Basic principles of BLS. The basic principles of BLS are the same for infants, children, and adults. For the purposes of BLS, anyone younger than 1 year is considered an infant. A child is between 1 year of age and the onset of puberty, approximately 12 to 14 years of age, as signified by breast development in girls and underarm, chest, and facial hair in boys. Adulthood is from the onset of puberty and older. Children vary in size. Some small children may be best treated as infants, some larger children as adults. There are two basic differences in providing CPR for infants, children, and adults. The first is that the emergencies in which infants and children require CPR usually have different underlying causes. The second is that there are anatomic differences in adults, children, and infants, such as smaller airways in infants and children than in adults. Although cardiac arrest in adults usually occurs before respiratory arrest, the reverse is true in infants and children. In most cases, cardiac arrest in children results from respiratory arrest. If untreated, respiratory arrest will quickly lead to cardiac arrest and death. Respiratory arrest in infants and children has a variety of causes discussed later in this chapter. Automated external defibrillation. Most pre-hospital cardiac arrests occur as the result of a sudden cardiac rhythm disturbance or dysrhythmia, such as ventricular fibrillation or VFib, or pulseless ventricular tachycardia or VTAC. The normal heart rhythm is known as normal sinus rhythm. VFib is the disorganized quivering of the ventricles, resulting in no forward blood flow and a state of cardiac arrest. VTAC is a rapid contraction of the ventricles that does not allow for normal filling of the heart. As mentioned previously, according to the AHA, early defibrillation is the link in the chain of survival that is most likely to improve survival rates. The likelihood of survival decreases rapidly over time as long as VFib or pulseless VTAC persist. When a patient is in cardiac arrest, begin CPR, starting with high-quality chest compressions, and apply an AED as soon as it is available. If indicated, then defibrillate immediately. Chapter 16, Cardiovascular Emergencies, covers AED use in detail. AED usage in children. AEDs can be safely used in children using the pediatric-sized pads and a dose attenuating system, or energy reducer. However, if these items are unavailable, Use adult-sized AED pads. Apply the AED to infants or children after the first 5 cycles of CPR have been completed. Recall that cardiac arrest in children is usually the result of respiratory failure. Therefore, oxygenation and ventilation are vitally important. After the first 5 cycles of CPR, use the AED to deliver shocks in the same manner as with an adult patient. If the patient is an infant, that is, between 1 month and 1 year of age, then a manual defibrillator is preferred to an AED. However, this is an ALS skill. As with any cardiac arrest situation, call for ALS backup immediately. If ALS backup with a manual defibrillator is unavailable, then an AED equipped with pediatric-sized pads and a dose attenuator is preferred. If neither is available, then use an AED with adult-sized pads. If you use adult-sized AED pads on an infant or small child, then do not cut the pads to adjust the size. Instead, use the anterior-posterior placement, following the manufacturer's recommendation. Special AED situations. It is essential to ensure the safety of yourself, others at the scene, and the patient. As such, keep the following factors in mind when using an AED. Pacemakers and implanted defibrillators. You may encounter a patient who has an automated implanted cardioverter defibrillator, or AICD, or pacemaker that delivers shocks directly to the heart if necessary. These devices are used in patients who are at a high risk for certain cardiac dysrhythmias and cardiac arrest. It is easy to recognize AICDs or pacemakers because they create a hard lump beneath the skin, usually on the upper left side of the chest, just below the clavicle. If the AED pads are placed directly over the device, then the effectiveness of the shock delivered by the AED may be reduced, and the shock could potentially damage the implanted device. Therefore, if you identify an AICD or pacemaker, then you should place the AED pads at least 1 inch or 2.5 centimeters away from the device. Occasionally, the implanted device will deliver shocks to the patient. If you observe the patient's muscles twitching as if he or she was just shocked, then continue CPR and wait 30 to 60 seconds before delivering a shock from the AED. Wet patients. Water conducts electricity. Therefore, the AED should not be used in water. If the patient's chest is wet, then the electrical current may move across the skin rather than between the pads to the patient's heart. If the patient is submerged in water, then pull him or her out of the water and quickly dry the skin before attaching the AED pads. Do not delay CPR to try to dry the patient thoroughly. Instead, quickly wipe off as much moisture as possible from the chest. If your patient is lying in a small puddle of water or in the snow, the AED can be used, but again, the patient's chest should be quickly dried as much as possible. Transdermal medication patches. You may encounter a patient who is receiving medication through a transdermal medication patch, such as nitroglycerin. The medication is absorbed through the skin. The patch could reduce the flow of electrical current from the AED to the heart and may burn the skin. If the medication patch interferes with the AED pad placement, then remove the patch with your gloved hands and wipe the skin to remove any residue prior to attaching the AED pad. Positioning the patient. For CPR to be effective, the patient must be lying supine on a firm, flat surface with enough clear space around the patient for 2 rescuers to perform CPR and use the AED. If the patient is crumpled up or lying face down or prone, then you will need to move him or her to a supine position. Be mindful that you cannot rule out a spinal injury in an unresponsive patient. Therefore, protect the patient's neck and move him or her as a unit without twisting. If the patient is found in a bed, then move him or her to the floor. If possible, log roll the patient onto a long backboard as you position him or her for CPR. Do this as quickly and safely as possible. A backboard will provide support during transport and emergency care. After the patient is properly positioned, you can easily assess the patient to determine whether CPR and defibrillation are necessary. Check for breathing and a pulse. After you have determined that the patient is unresponsive, quickly check for breathing and a pulse. These assessments can occur simultaneously and should take no longer than 10 seconds in total. Visualize the chest for signs of breathing while palpating for a carotid pulse. Feel for the carotid artery by locating the larynx at the front of the neck and then sliding 2 fingers toward one side, the side closest to you. The pulse is felt in the groove between the larynx and the sternocleidomastoid muscle, with the pads of the index and middle fingers held side by side. Light pressure is sufficient to palpate the pulse. Provide external chest compressions. If the patient is not breathing or is breathing only slowly or occasionally, known as agonal gasps, and does not have a pulse, then begin CPR starting with chest compressions. It is critical to perform compressions properly. Chest compressions are administered by applying rhythmic pressure and relaxation to the lower half of the sternum. The heart is located slightly to the left of the middle of the chest between the sternum and the spine. Compressions squeeze the heart, thereby acting as a pump to circulate blood. Allow the chest to completely recoil between compressions, which enhances blood return to the heart. Do not lean on the chest between compressions. When artificial ventilation is provided, the blood that is circulated through the lungs during chest compressions is likely to receive adequate oxygen to maintain tissue perfusion. However, even when external chest compressions are performed properly, they circulate only one-third of the blood that is normally pumped by the heart. Proper hand position and compression technique. With the adult patient, correct hand position is established by placing the heel of one hand on the sternum in the center of the chest, that is, the lower half of the sternum. 1. Take standard precautions. 2. Place the heel of one hand on the center of the chest over the lower half of the sternum. 3. Place the heel of your other hand over the first hand. 4. With your arms straight, lock your elbows and position your shoulders directly over your hands so that the thrust of each compression is straight down on the sternum. Your technique may be improved or made more comfortable if you interlock the fingers of your lower hand with the fingers of your upper hand. Either way, keep your fingers off the patient's ribs. 5. Depress the sternum to a depth of 2 inches to 2.4 inches, or 5 centimeters to 6 centimeters, using direct downward movement and then rising gently upward. This motion allows pressure to be delivered vertically from your shoulders. Downward pressure produces a compression that must be followed immediately by an equal period of relaxation. The ratio of time devoted to compression versus relaxation should be 1:1. It is important that you allow the chest to return to its normal position. Do not lean on the patient's chest between compressions. Compression and relaxation should be of equal duration. Complications from chest compressions are rare, but can include fractured ribs, a lacerated liver, and a fractured sternum. Although these injuries cannot be entirely avoided, you can minimize the chance that they will occur if you use good technique and proper hand placement. Your motion should be smooth, rhythmic, and uninterrupted. Short jabbing compressions are not effective in producing artificial blood flow. Do not remove the heel of your hand from the patient's chest during relaxation, but make sure that you completely release pressure on the sternum so that it can return to its normal resting position between compressions. Opening the airway and providing artificial ventilation. Without an open airway, rescue breathing will not be effective. As discussed in Chapter 10, Airway Management, the two techniques for opening the airway in adult are the head tilt chin lift maneuver and the jaw thrust maneuver. These manual maneuvers are designed to bring the tongue forward and off the back of the throat. The head tilt chin lift maneuver is effective for opening the airway in most patients where there is no indication of a spinal injury. In patients who have not sustained trauma, this simple maneuver is sometimes all that is required for the patient to resume breathing. If the patient has any foreign material or vomitus in the mouth, then quickly remove it. Remove any liquid materials from the mouth with a suction device. Use your hooked index finger to remove any solid material. If spinal injury is suspected, then use the jaw thrust maneuver. Do not tilt the patient's head back because you want to minimize movement of the patient's neck. To perform a jaw thrust maneuver, place your fingers behind the angles of the patient's lower jaw and then move the jaw upward. Keep the head in a neutral position as you move the jaw upward and open the mouth. If the patient's mouth remains closed, then you can use your thumbs to pull down the patient's lower lip to allow breathing. If the jaw thrust fails to open the airway, then the head tilt chin lift should be used to open the airway. An open airway is the primary goal when caring for trauma patients, and you must ensure an open airway to improve survival. Recovery position. If the patient is breathing adequately on his or her own and has no signs of injury to the spine, hip, or pelvis, then place him or her in the recovery position. This position helps to maintain a clear airway in a patient with a decreased level of consciousness who has not sustained traumatic injuries and is breathing adequately on his or her own. It also allows vomitus to drain from the mouth. Roll the patient onto his or her side so that the head, shoulders, and torso move as a unit without twisting. Then place the top hand under his or her cheek. Never place a patient who has a suspected head or spinal injury in the recovery position because in this position, the spine is not aligned. spinal stabilization is not possible, and further spinal injury could result. Likewise, if the patient has a hip or pelvic injury, then positioning the patient on his or her side could cause fractured bone ends to compress or sever large arteries and veins, resulting in severe internal bleeding. You should suspect an associated spinal injury in any unresponsive patient with a hip or pelvic injury until proven otherwise. Breathing. A lack of oxygen or hypoxia combined with too much carbon dioxide in the blood or hypercarbia is lethal. To correct this condition, you must provide slow, deliberate ventilations that last 1 second. This gentle, slow method of ventilating the patient prevents air from being forced. Provide artificial ventilations. Ventilations can be given by one or two EMS providers. Use a barrier device when you administer ventilations in the pre-hospital environment, such as a pocket mask with a one-way valve or a BVM. Use devices that supply supplemental oxygen when possible. Devices with an oxygen reservoir will provide higher percentages of oxygen to the patient. Regardless of whether you ventilate the patient with or without supplemental oxygen, you should observe the chest for visible rise to assess the effectiveness of your ventilations. The specific steps of CPR are discussed later in this chapter. Pediatric BLS procedures are summarized later in this chapter. Resuscitation of a neonate is discussed in Chapter 33, Obstetrics and Neonatal Care. Recall from Chapter 10, Airway Management, that hyperventilation or ventilating too fast or with too much force may cause increased intrathoracic pressure, that is, pressure inside the chest cavity. Increased intrathoracic pressure reduces the amount of blood that returns to the heart, thus decreasing the effectiveness of chest compressions and resulting in the heart and brain receiving decreased amounts of oxygen. Stoma ventilation. Patients who have undergone a laryngectomy or surgical removal of the larynx often have a permanent tracheal stoma at the midline in the neck. In this case, a stoma is an opening that connects the trachea directly to the skin. Because it is at the midline, the stoma is the only opening that will move air into the patient's lungs. Patients with a stoma should be ventilated with a BVM or pocket mask device placed directly over the stoma. Not all stomas are disconnected from the nose and mouth. If air leakage through the nose and mouth interferes with ventilation through the stoma, then cover the nose and mouth with your hand to make a seal. Use a pediatric or infant mask to ventilate through the stoma. Gastric distension. Artificial ventilation may result in the stomach becoming filled with air, a condition called gastric distension. Although it occurs more easily in children, this condition also happens frequently in adults. Gastric distension is likely to occur if you hyperventilate the patient. If you ventilate too forcefully, or if the patient's airway is not opened adequately, then the excess gas opens up the collapsible tube, that is, the esophagus, and allows gas to enter the stomach. Therefore, it is important for you to give slow, gentle breaths. Such breaths are also more effective in ventilating the lungs. Excessive inflation of the stomach is dangerous because it can cause the patient to vomit during CPR. It can also reduce lung volume by elevating the diaphragm. If massive gastric distension interferes with adequate ventilation, then contact medical control. Check the airway again and reposition the patient. Watch for rise and fall of the chest and avoid giving forceful breaths. Have a suction unit available in case the patient vomits. Remember, mortality increases significantly if aspiration occurs. If an ALS provider is available, then he or she can insert an orogastric or nasogastric tube to decompress the stomach. One Rescuer Adult CPR. When you provide CPR alone, you must provide a continuous cycle of 30 chest compressions followed by 2 artificial ventilations, a ratio of 30 to 2. To perform One Rescuer Adult CPR, follow these steps. 1. Take standard precautions. Establish unresponsiveness and call for additional help. Use your mobile phone if needed. 2. Position the patient properly, that is, supine, on a flat surface. 3. Quickly visualize the chest for signs of breathing while simultaneously palpating for a carotid pulse. Take no more than 10 seconds in total to do this. 4. If pulse and breathing are absent, then perform CPR until an AED is available. Place your hands in the proper direction for delivering external chest compressions as described previously. Give 30 chest compressions at a rate of 100 to 120 per minute for an adult. Each set of 30 compressions should take about 17 seconds. 5. Open the airway according to your suspicion of spinal injury. 6. Give two ventilations of 1 second each and observe for visible chest rise. 7. Continue cycles of 30 chest compressions and 2 ventilations until additional personnel arrive or the patient starts to move. 2 rescuer adult CPR. You and your team should be able to perform 1 rescuer and 2 rescuer CPR with ease. 2 rescuer CPR is always preferable because it is less tiring and it facilitates effective chest compressions. In fact, a team approach to CPR and AED use is far superior to the 1 rescuer approach. Once 1 rescuer CPR is in progress, additional rescuers can be added to the procedure easily. Before assisting with CPR, a second rescuer should apply the AED and then set up airway adjuncts, including a BVM and suction, and insert an oral pharyngeal or oral airway. If CPR is in progress, then the second rescuer should enter the procedure after a cycle of 30 compressions and 2 ventilations. To perform 2 rescuer adult CPR, follow these steps. 1. Take standard precautions. Establish unresponsiveness while your partner moves to the patient's side to be ready to deliver chest compressions. 2. If the patient is unresponsive, then simultaneously check for breathing and palpate for a carotid pulse. Take no more than 10 seconds to do this. 3. If the patient is not breathing and has no pulse, then begin CPR, starting with chest compressions. Give 30 chest compressions at a rate of 100 to 120 per minute. If an AED is available, then apply it and follow its voice prompts. Do not interrupt chest compressions to apply the AED pads. 4. Open the airway according to your suspicion of spinal injury. 5. Give 2 ventilations of 1 second each and observe for visible chest rise. 6. Perform 5 cycles of 30 compressions and 2 ventilations. This should take about 2 minutes. After 2 minutes of CPR, the compressor and ventilator should switch positions. The switch time should take no longer than 5 seconds. Reanalyze the patient's cardiac rhythm with the AED every 2 minutes and deliver a shock if indicated. 7. Continue cycles of 30 chest compressions and 2 ventilations until ALS providers take over or the patient starts to move. Switching positions. It is critical to switch rescuers during CPR to maintain high-quality compressions. After 5 cycles of CPR, about 2 minutes, the rescuer providing compressions to the patient, that is the compressor, will begin to tire and compression quality will decrease. Therefore, compressors should switch positions every 2 minutes. If there are only 2 rescuers on scene, then the 2 rescuers will alternate positions. If additional rescuers are available, the compressor should rotate every 2 minutes. During switches, every effort should be made to minimize the time that no compressions are being administered. It should take less than 5 seconds to switch compressors. The switch between the 2 rescuers can be easily accomplished. Rescuer 1, that is the first compressor, should finish the cycle of 30 compressions while the second rescuer moves to the opposite side of the chest and moves into position to begin compressions. Rescuer 1 should deliver 2 rescue breaths, and then Rescuer 2 should take over compressions by administering 30 chest compressions. Rescuer 1 will then deliver 2 ventilations, and the CPR cycles will continue as needed until the next 2-minute mark or 5 cycles is reached, at which time the process will be repeated. Devices and techniques to assist circulation. The effectiveness of CPR depends on the amount of blood circulated throughout the body as a result of chest compressions. Even under ideal conditions, however, manual chest compressions cannot equate to normal cardiac output. In addition, factors such as rescuer fatigue or inaccurate depth or rate of compressions can further impede the resuscitation process. Before you consider the use of mechanical devices to assist circulation, ensure that your manual chest compressions are of consistently high quality. Several mechanical devices are available to assist emergency responders in maximizing blood flow during CPR. Although improved patient outcomes have not yet been documented, these devices may be considered for use as an adjunct to CPR in select settings when used by properly trained personnel for patients in cardiac arrest in the pre-hospital or in-hospital setting. These specific settings include instances when limited rescuers are available, when CPR is prolonged, or when CPR is required in a moving ambulance. Active compression decompression CPR is a technique that involves compressing the chest and then actively pulling it back up to its neutral position or beyond. Decompression. This technique may increase the amount of blood that returns to the heart and thus the amount of blood ejected from the heart during the compression phase. An active compression decompression CPR device features a suction cup that is placed in the center of the chest. After compressing the chest to its proper depth, the rescuer pulls up on the handle of the device to provide active decompression of the chest, thus ensuring that the chest returns to at least its neutral position or even beyond neutral. Impedance threshold device. An impedance threshold device, or ITD, is a valve device placed between the ET tube and a BVM. It may also be placed between the bag and mask if an ET tube is not in place. The ITD is designed to limit the air entering the lungs during the recoil phase between chest compressions. This results in negative intrathoracic pressure that may draw more blood toward the heart, ultimately resulting in improved cardiac filling and circulation during each chest compression. The ITD may be considered when used together with devices that provide active compression-decompression CPR. It is not currently recommended for use with conventional CPR. If ROSC occurs, then the ITD should be removed. You should understand research trends regarding the effectiveness of the ITD. Mechanical piston device. A mechanical piston device is a device that depresses the sternum via a compressed, gas-powered or electric-powered plunger mounted on a backboard. The patient is positioned supine on the backboard with the piston positioned on top of the patient with the plunger centered over the patient's thorax in the same manner as with manual chest compressions. The device is then secured to the backboard. The mechanical piston device allows rescuers to configure the depth and rate of compressions, resulting in consistent delivery. This frees the rescuer to complete other tasks and eliminates rescuer fatigue that results from continuous delivery of manual chest compressions. These devices have been available for many years. The latest versions of these devices offer you the option of providing compressions using a battery instead of an oxygen tank or a compressed air system, thus eliminating the tanks and hoses. Load distributing band CPR or vest CPR. The load distributing band or LDB is a circumferential chest compression device composed of constricting band and backboard. The device is either electrically or pneumatically driven to compress the heart by putting inward pressure on the thorax. As with the mechanical piston device, use of the LDB frees the rescuer to complete other tasks. The device weighs less than the early version mechanical piston devices and can be easier to apply. Although a mechanical CPR device may be a reasonable alternative to conventional CPR in specific settings, manual chest compressions remain the standard of care. If your EMS service uses a mechanical CPR device, then it is critical to practice frequently to ensure that you can apply it rapidly. Remember to minimize interruptions to chest compressions while the device is being applied. Infant and child CPR. In most cases, cardiac arrest in infants and children follows respiratory arrest, which triggers hypoxia and ischemia, or decreased oxygen supply, of the heart. Children consume oxygen 2 to 3 times as rapidly as adults, so you must first focus on opening the airway and providing artificial ventilation. Often, this will be enough to allow the child to resume spontaneous breathing and, thus, prevent cardiac arrest. Therefore, airway and breathing are the focus of pediatric BLS. As discussed in Chapter 34, Pediatric Emergencies, respiratory issues leading to cardiopulmonary arrest in children can have a number of different causes, including injury, both blunt and penetrating, infections of the respiratory tract or another organ system, such as croup and epiglottitis, a foreign body in the airway, submersion or drowning, electrocution, poisoning or drug overdose, sudden infant death syndrome or SIDS. Determining responsiveness. Never shake a child to determine whether he or she is responsive, especially if the possibility of a neck or back injury exists. Instead, gently tap the child on the shoulder and say loudly, "Are you okay?" With an infant, gently tap the soles of the feet. If a child is responsive but struggling to breathe, then allow him or her to remain in whatever position is most comfortable. If you find an unresponsive, apneic, and pulseless child while you are alone and off duty and you did not witness the child's collapse, perform CPR beginning with chest compressions for approximately 5 cycles, about 2 minutes, and then stop to call 911 and retrieve an AED. Do not call 911 right away as you would with an adult. Remember that cardiopulmonary arrest in children is most often the result of respiratory failure, not a primary cardiac event. Therefore, children will require immediate restoration of oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation, which can be accomplished by immediately performing 5 cycles, about 2 minutes of CPR before activating the EMS system. Check for breathing and a pulse. After you establish responsiveness, you need to assess breathing and circulation. As with an adult, this assessment can occur simultaneously and should take no longer than 10 seconds. Visualize the chest for signs of breathing and palpate for a pulse in a large central artery. You can usually palpate the carotid or femoral pulse in children older than 1 year, but it is difficult in infants. Therefore, in infants, palpate the brachial artery, which is located on the inner side of the arm, midway between the elbow and shoulder. Place your thumb on the outer surface of the arm between the elbow and shoulder. Then place the tips of your index and middle fingers on the inside of the biceps and press lightly toward the bone. CPR will be required if the infant or child is not breathing or is not breathing normally with agonal gasps and a pulse is absent or less than 60 beats per minute. As with an adult, an infant or child must be lying on a hard, flat surface for effective chest compressions. If you need to carry an infant while providing CPR, then your forearm and hand can serve as the flat surface. Use your palm to support the infant's head. In this way, the infant's shoulders are elevated and the head is slightly tilted back in a position that will keep the airway open. Ensure that the infant's head is not higher than the rest of the body. The technique for chest compressions in infants and children differs from adults because of a number of anatomic differences, including the position of the heart, the size of the chest, and the fragile organs of a child. The liver, which is located immediately under the right side of the diaphragm, is relatively large and fragile, especially in infants. The spleen, on the left, is smaller and more fragile in children than in adults. These organs are easily injured if you are not careful in performing chest compressions, so be sure that your hand position is correct before you begin. The chest of an infant is smaller and more pliable than that of an older child or adult. Therefore, you should use only 2 fingers to compress the chest. If 2 rescuers are performing CPR on an infant, use the 2-thumb encircling hands technique to deliver chest compressions. In children, especially those older than 8 years, you can use the heel of 1 or both hands to compress the chest. Follow these steps to perform infant chest compressions. 1. Take standard precautions. Place the infant on a firm surface using 1 hand to keep the head in an open airway position. You can also use a pad or wedge under the shoulders and upper body to keep the head from tilting forward. 2. Imagine a line drawn between the nipples. Place 2 fingers in the middle of the sternum just below the nipple line. 3. Using 2 fingers, compress the sternum at least 1/3 the anterior-posterior diameter of the chest, approximately 1.5 inches or 4 centimeters in most infants. Compress the chest at a rate of 100 to 120 per minute. 4. After each compression, allow the sternum to return briefly to its normal position. Allow equal time for compression and relaxation of the chest. Do not remove your fingers from the sternum and avoid jerky movements. Coordinate compressions and ventilations in a 30-to-2 ratio if you are working alone and 15-to-2 if you are working with a trained bystander or another healthcare provider. Ensure the infant's chest fully recoils in between compressions and that the chest visibly rises with each ventilation. You will find this easier to do if you use your free hand to keep the head in the open airway position. If the chest does not rise or rises only a little, then use a head tilt chin lift to open the airway. Reassess the infant for signs of spontaneous breathing or a pulse after 5 cycles, about 2 minutes of CPR. Follow these steps for performing CPR in children between 1 year of age and the onset of puberty. 1. Take standard precautions. Place the child on a firm surface. Place the heel of 1 or 2 hands in the center of the chest, in between the nipples. Avoid compression over the lower tip of the sternum, which is called the xiphoid process. 2. Compress the chest at least 1/3 the anterior-posterior diameter of the chest, approximately 2 inches or 5 centimeters in most children, at a rate of 100 to 120 per minute. With pauses for ventilation, the actual number of compressions delivered will be about 80 per minute. In between compressions, allow the chest to fully recoil. Do not lean on the chest. Compression and relaxation time should be the same duration. Use smooth movements, hold your fingers off the child's ribs, and keep the heel of your hands on the sternum. 3. Coordinate compressions and ventilations in a 30-to-2 ratio for 1 rescuer and 15-to-2 for 2 rescuers. Make sure the chest rises with each ventilation. At the end of each cycle, pause for 2 ventilations. 4. After 5 cycles, about 2 minutes, reassess for a pulse. If there is no pulse and you have an AED, continue CPR and apply the AED pads. 5. If the child regains a pulse of greater than 60 beats per minute and resumes effective breathing, place him or her in a position that allows for frequent assessment of the airway and vital signs during transport. Switching rescuer positions is the same for children as it is for adults. Every 5 cycles, 2 minutes of CPR. Remember, if the child is past the onset of puberty, use the adult CPR sequence, including the use of the AED. Airway. Infants and toddlers often put toys and other objects as well as food in their mouths. Therefore, foreign body obstruction of the upper airway is common. You must make sure that the upper airway is open when managing pediatric respiratory emergencies or cardiopulmonary arrest. If the child is unresponsive and lying in a supine position, then the airway may become obstructed when the tongue and throat muscles relax and the tongue falls backward. If the child is unresponsive but breathing adequately, then place him or her in the recovery position to maintain an open airway and allow drainage of saliva, vomitus, or other secretions from the mouth. Do not use this position if you suspect injury to the spine, hips, or pelvis unless you can secure the child to a backboard that can be tilted to the side. If the child is responsive and breathing, but in a labored fashion, then provide prompt transport to the closest appropriate hospital. Opening the airway in an infant or child is done by using the same techniques as used for an adult. However, because a child's neck is so flexible, the technique should be slightly modified. The jaw thrust maneuver is the best method to use if you suspect a spinal injury in a child. If a second rescuer is present, he or she should immobilize the child's cervical spine. If spinal injury is not suspected, then use the head tilt chin lift maneuver but modified so that as you tilt the head back, you are moving it only into the neutral position or a slightly extended position. Head tilt chin lift maneuver. Perform the head tilt chin lift maneuver in a child in the following manner. 1. Place one hand on the child's forehead and tilt the head back gently, with the neck slightly extended. 2. Place 2 or 3 fingers, not the thumb, of your other hand under the child's chin and lift the jaw upward and outward. Do not close the mouth or push under the chin. Either move may obstruct rather than open the airway. 3. Remove any visible foreign body or vomitus. Jaw thrust maneuver. Perform the jaw thrust maneuver in a child in the following manner. 1. Place 2 or 3 fingers under each side of the angle of the lower jaw. Lift the jaw upward and outward. 2. If the jaw thrust alone does not open the airway and cervical spine injury is not a consideration, then tilt the head slightly. If cervical spine injury is suspected, then use a second rescuer to immobilize the cervical spine. Remember that the head of an infant or young child is disproportionately large in comparison with the chest and shoulders. As a result, when a child is lying flat on his or her back, especially on a backboard, the head will bend forward, hyperflexion, onto the upper chest. This position can partially or completely obstruct the upper airway. To avoid this possibility, place a wedge of padding under the child's upper chest and shoulders, or torso. Provide rescue breathing. If the child is not breathing but has a pulse, then open the airway and deliver one breath every 3 to 5 seconds, or 12 to 20 breaths per minute. If the child is not breathing and does not have a pulse, then deliver 2 rescue breaths after every 30 chest compressions, 15 chest compressions if 2 rescuers are present. Each ventilation should last about 1 second and should produce visible chest rise. Use the proper sized mask and ensure an adequate mask-to-face seal. If an infant or small child is breathing, then provide prompt transport. Again, a child who is in respiratory distress should be allowed to stay in whatever position is most comfortable. Children who are unresponsive but breathing with difficulty should be kept in a position that allows you to manage the airway and provide ventilatory support if needed. In a child with a tracheostomy tube in the neck, remove the mask from the BVM and connect it directly to the tracheostomy tube to ventilate the child. If a BVM is unavailable, a face mask with one-way valve or other barrier device over the tracheostomy site can be used. Place your hand firmly over the child's mouth and nose to prevent the artificial breaths from leaking out of the upper airway. Interrupting CPR. CPR is a crucial life-saving procedure that provides minimal circulation and ventilation until the patient can receive defibrillation, ALS treatment, and definitive care at the ED. No matter how well CPR is performed, however, it is rarely enough to save a patient's life. If ALS is unavailable at the scene, you must provide transport based on your local protocols and continue CPR on the way. En route to the ED, consider requesting a rendezvous with ALS providers if available. This will provide ALS care to the patient sooner, improving his or her chance for survival. However, not all EMS systems have ALS support available to them, especially in rural settings. Try not to interrupt CPR for more than a few seconds, except when it is absolutely necessary. For example, if you have to move a patient up or downstairs, you should continue CPR until you arrive at the head or foot of the stairs. Interrupt CPR at a mutually agreed-on signal and move quickly to the next level where you can resume CPR. Do not move the patient until all transport arrangements are made so that interruptions to CPR can be kept to a minimum. See Chapter 8, Lifting and Moving Patients, to review patient lifting and moving techniques. Chest compression fraction is the total percentage of time during a resuscitation attempt in which chest compressions are being performed. Make every effort to maintain a chest compression fraction of at least 60%, the higher the better. The more frequent the interruptions in chest compressions, the lower the compression fraction will be. Low compression fractions lead to worse patient outcomes. Most modern cardiac monitors will provide information about chest compression fraction that you can review after a cardiac arrest. If possible, routinely review this information after every arrest so that you can learn ways to improve the chest compression fraction and improve on other key performance indicators. When not to start CPR. As an EMT, it is your responsibility to start CPR on virtually all patients who are in cardiac arrest. There are only three general exceptions to the rule. First, do not start CPR if the scene is unsafe. The concept of ensuring scene safety applies in cardiac arrest situations just as it does on any other call. Second, do not start CPR if the patient has obvious signs of death. Recall from Chapter 3, Medical, Legal, and Ethical Issues, that obvious signs of death include an absence of a pulse and breathing, along with any one of the following findings: rigor mortis, or stiffening of the body after death; dependent lividity, or liver mortis, a discoloration of the skin caused by pooling of blood; putrefaction, or decomposition of the body tissues; evidence of non-survivable injury, such as decapitation, dismemberment, or being burned beyond recognition. Rigor mortis and dependent lividity develop after a patient has been dead for a long period. Third, do not start CPR if the patient and his or her physician have previously agreed on a do not resuscitate or DNR order or no CPR order. DNR orders give you permission not to attempt resuscitation. This may apply only to situations in which the patient is known to be in the terminal stage of an incurable disease. In this situation, CPR would only prolong the patient's death. However, end-of-life issues can be complicated. Advanced directives, such as living wills, may express the patient's wishes. However, these documents may not be readily producible by the patient's family or caregiver. In such cases, the safest course is to begin CPR under the rule of implied consent and then contact medical control for further guidance. However, if a valid DNR document or living will is produced, resuscitative efforts may be withheld. Learn your local protocols and the standards in your EMS system for treating terminally ill patients. Some EMS systems have electronic notes on patients who are pre-registered with the system. These notes usually specify the amount and extent of treatment that is desired. Other states have specific DNR forms that allow EMS providers to withhold care when the patient, family, and physician have agreed in advance that such a course is most appropriate. It is essential that you understand your local protocols and are aware of the specific restrictions these advanced directives imply. You may also encounter physician orders for life-sustaining treatment, or PULSED, or medical orders for life-sustaining treatment, or MULST, forms. These legal documents describe acceptable interventions for the patient in the form of medical orders and must be signed by an authorized medical provider to be valid. Be familiar with PULSED or MULST forms and learn your local protocols and state laws with regard to withholding end-of-life medical interventions. If you are presented with a PULSED or MULST form, then contact medical control for guidance. In all other cases, begin CPR on anyone who is in cardiac arrest. It is usually impossible to know how long the patient's brain and vital organs have gone without oxygen. Factors such as air temperature and the basic health of the patient's tissues and organs can affect his or her ability to survive. Therefore, most legal advisors recommend that, when in doubt, always give too much care rather than too little care. Therefore, always start CPR if any doubt exists. When to stop CPR? As an EMT, you are generally not responsible for making the decision to stop CPR. After you begin CPR in the field, you must continue until one of the following events occurs, which can be remembered by using the STOP mnemonic. S. The patient starts breathing and has a pulse. T. The patient's care is transferred to another provider of equal or higher level training. O. You are out of strength or too tired to continue CPR. P. A physician who is present or providing online medical direction assumes responsibility for the patient and directs you to discontinue CPR. Out of strength does not mean merely weary. Rather, it means that you are no longer physically able to perform CPR. In short, always continue CPR until the patient's care is transferred to a physician or higher medical authority in the field. In some cases, your medical director or a designated medical control physician may order you to stop CPR on the basis of the patient's condition. Every EMS system should have clear standing orders or protocols that provide guidelines for starting and stopping CPR. Your medical director and your system's legal advisor should agree on these protocols, which should be closely administered and reviewed by your medical doctor. Foreign body airway obstruction in adults. Occasionally, a large foreign body will be aspirated and block the upper airway. An airway obstruction may be caused by various factors, including relaxation of the throat muscles in an unresponsive patient, vomited or regurgitated stomach contents, blood, damaged tissue after an injury, dentures, or foreign bodies such as food or small objects. Large objects that are visible but cannot be removed from the airway with suction, such as loose dentures, large pieces of food, or blood clots, should be swept forward and out with your gloved index finger. Suctioning can then be used as needed to keep the airway clear of thinner secretions such as blood, vomitus, and mucus. Recognizing foreign body airway obstruction. An airway obstruction by a foreign body in an adult usually occurs during a meal. In children, it usually occurs during mealtime or at play. If the foreign body is not removed quickly, then the lungs will use up their oxygen supply and unconsciousness and death will follow. Management is based on the severity of the airway obstruction. Mild airway obstruction. Patients with a mild or partial airway obstruction are able to exchange adequate amounts of air but still have signs of respiratory distress. Breathing may be noisy. However, the patient usually has a strong, effective cough. Leave these patients alone. Your main concern is to prevent a mild airway obstruction from becoming a severe or complete airway obstruction. Abdominal thrusts are not indicated for patients with a mild airway obstruction. For the patient with a mild airway obstruction, first encourage him or her to cough or to continue coughing if they are already doing so. Do not interfere with the patient's own attempts to expel the foreign body. Instead, give supplemental oxygen if needed and provide prompt transport to the ED. Closely monitor the patient and observe for signs of a severe airway obstruction, such as a weak or absent cough, decreasing level of consciousness, and cyanosis. Responsive patients. A sudden severe airway obstruction is usually easy to recognize in someone who is eating or has just finished eating. The person is suddenly unable to speak or cough, grasps his or her throat, turns cyanotic, or makes exaggerated efforts to breathe. Either air is not moving into and out of the airway, or the air movement is so slight that it is not detectable. At first, the patient will be responsive and able to clearly indicate the problem. Ask the patient, "Are you choking?" The patient will usually answer by nodding yes. Alternatively, he or she may use the universal sign to indicate airway blockage. If there is a minimal amount of air movement, then you may hear a high-pitched sound called stridor. This occurs when the object is not fully blocking the airway, but the small amount of air entering the lungs is not enough to sustain life, and the patient will eventually become unconscious if the obstruction is not relieved. Unresponsive patients. When you discover an unresponsive patient, your first step is to determine whether he or she is breathing and has a pulse. The unconsciousness may be caused by airway obstruction, cardiac arrest, or a number of other conditions. If the patient has a pulse but is not breathing, then you must make sure that the airway is open and unobstructed. You should suspect an airway obstruction if the standard maneuvers to open the airway and ventilate the lungs are ineffective. If you feel resistance when attempting to ventilate, the patient probably has some type of obstruction. removing a foreign body airway obstruction in an adult. The manual maneuver recommended for removing severe airway obstructions in responsive adults and children older than 1 year is the abdominal thrust maneuver, also called the Heimlich maneuver. This technique creates an artificial cough caused by causing a sudden increase in intrathoracic pressure when thrusts are applied to the subdiaphragmatic region. It is a very effective method for removing a foreign body obstruction from the airway. If the patient with a severe airway obstruction is unresponsive, then perform chest compressions. Responsive patients. Abdominal thrust maneuver. The goal of the abdominal thrust maneuver is to compress the lungs upward and force residual air from the lungs to flow upwards and expel the object. In responsive patients with a severe airway obstruction, repeat abdominal thrusts until the foreign body is expelled or the patient becomes unresponsive. Each thrust should be deliberate with the intent of relieving the obstruction. To perform abdominal thrusts on a responsive adult, use the following technique. 1. Stand behind the patient and wrap your arms around his or her abdomen. Straddle your legs outside the patient's legs. This will allow you to easily slide the patient to the ground if he or she becomes unresponsive. 2. Make a fist with one hand. Grasp the fist with the other hand. Place the thumb side of the fist against the patient's abdomen just above the umbilicus and well below the xiphoid process. 3. Press your fist into the patient's abdomen with a quick inward and upward thrust. 4. Continue abdominal thrusts until the object is expelled from the airway or the patient becomes unresponsive. Chest thrusts. You can perform the abdominal thrust maneuver safely on all adults and children. However, for women in advanced stages of pregnancy and patients who have obesity, use chest thrusts instead. To perform chest thrusts on the responsive adult, use the following technique. 1. Stand behind the patient with your arms directly under the patient's armpits and wrap your arms around the patient's chest. 2. Make a fist with one hand. Grasp the fist with the other hand. Place the thumb side of the fist against the patient's sternum, avoiding the xiphoid process and the edges of the rib cage. 3. Press your fist into the patient's chest with backward thrusts until the object is expelled or the patient becomes unresponsive. 4. If the patient becomes unresponsive, then begin CPR starting with chest compressions. 4. Responsive patients who become unresponsive. A patient with an airway obstruction may become unresponsive while you are attempting to remove the obstruction. In this case, begin CPR starting with chest compressions. Use the following steps to manage the patient's airway obstruction. 1. Carefully support the patient to the ground and immediately call for help or send someone to call for help. 2. Perform 30 chest compressions, using the same landmark as you would for CPR, that is, the center of the chest between the nipples. Do not check for a pulse before performing chest compressions. 3. Open the airway and look in the mouth. If you see an object that can be easily removed, then remove it with your fingers and attempt to ventilate. If you do not see an object, then resume chest compressions. 4. Repeat steps 2 and 3 until the obstruction is relieved or ALS providers take over. If you are able to remove an object from the mouth, then attempt to ventilate. If ventilation produces chest rise, then continue to ventilate and check for a pulse. If a pulse is present but the patient is not breathing, then continue rescue breathing and monitor the pulse. If a pulse is absent, then continue CPR, compressions, and ventilations, and apply the AED as soon as it is available. Unresponsive patients. When a patient is found unresponsive, it is unlikely you will know what caused the problem. Begin CPR by determining unresponsiveness and checking for breathing and a pulse. If a pulse is present but breathing is absent, then open the airway and attempt to ventilate. If the first ventilation does not produce visible chest rise, then reposition the airway and reattempt to ventilate. If both ventilation attempts do not produce visible chest rise, then perform 30 chest compressions, and then open the airway and look in the mouth. If an object is visible and can easily be removed, then remove it with your fingers and attempt to ventilate. Never perform blind finger sweeps on any patient. Doing so may push the obstruction further into the airway. If an object is not visible or cannot easily be removed, then resume chest compressions. Continue the sequence of chest compressions, opening the airway and looking inside the mouth until the airway is clear or ALS providers arrive. Foreign body airway obstruction in infants and children. As mentioned previously, airway obstruction is a common problem in infants and children usually caused by a foreign body, such as food or a toy, or by an infection, resulting in swelling and narrowing of the airway. Try to identify the cause of the obstruction as soon as possible. In patients who have signs and symptoms of an airway infection, do not waste time trying to dislodge a foreign body. Administer supplemental oxygen if needed, and immediately transport the child to the ED. A previously healthy child who is eating or playing with small toys, or an infant who is crawling around the house and who suddenly has difficulty breathing, has probably aspirated a foreign body. As in adults, foreign bodies may cause a mild or a severe airway obstruction. With a mild airway obstruction, the child can cough forcefully, although he or she may wheeze between coughs. As long as the patient can breathe, cough, or talk, do not interfere with his or her attempts to expel the foreign body. As with the adult, encourage the child to continue coughing. Administer supplemental oxygen if needed and tolerated, and provide transport to the ED. You should intervene only if signs of a severe airway obstruction develop, such as a weak, ineffective cough, cyanosis, stridor, absent air movement, or a decreasing level of consciousness. Removing a foreign body airway obstruction in a child. Responsive child. If you determine a child older than 1 year has an airway obstruction, then stand or kneel behind the child and provide abdominal thrusts in the same manner as an adult, but use less force until the object is expelled or the child becomes unresponsive. If the child becomes unresponsive, then follow the same steps as for the unresponsive adult. To perform the abdominal thrust maneuver in a responsive child who is in a standing or sitting position, follow these steps. 1. Kneel on one knee behind the child and circle both of your arms around the child's body. Prepare to give abdominal thrusts by placing your fist just above the patient's umbilicus and well below the xiphoid process. Place your other hand over that fist. 2. Give the child abdominal thrusts in an upward direction. Avoid applying force to the lower rib cage or sternum. 3. Repeat this technique until the child expels the foreign body or becomes unresponsive. 4. If the child becomes unresponsive, position the child on a hard surface and immediately call for help or send someone to call for help. 5. Perform 30 chest compressions or 15 compressions if two rescuers are present, using the same landmark as you would for CPR. Do not check for a pulse before performing chest compressions. 6. Open the airway and look inside the mouth. If you see an object that can be easily removed, then remove it with your fingers and attempt to ventilate. If you do not see an object, then resume chest compressions. 7. Repeat steps 5 and 6 until the obstruction is relieved or ALS providers take over. If you manage to clear the airway obstruction in an unresponsive child, but he or she still has no spontaneous breathing or circulation, then perform CPR, compressions, and ventilations, and apply the AED as soon as it is available. Unresponsive child. If a child older than 1 year with an airway obstruction becomes unresponsive, he or she is managed in the same manner as an adult. Follow these steps for removing a foreign body airway obstruction in an unresponsive child. 1. Take standard precautions. Carefully place the child in a supine position on a firm, flat surface. 2. Perform 30 chest compressions or 15 compressions if two rescuers are present, using the same landmark as you would for CPR, that is, the lower half of the sternum. Do not check for a pulse before performing chest compressions. 3. Open the airway and look in the mouth. 4. If you see an object that can easily be removed, then remove it with your fingers and attempt to ventilate. 5. If you do not see an object, then resume chest compressions. 6. Repeat the sequence of chest compressions, opening the airway and looking inside the mouth until the obstruction is relieved or ALS providers take over. Removing a foreign body airway obstruction in infants. Responsive infants. Do not use abdominal thrusts on a responsive infant with an airway obstruction because of the risk of injury to the immature organs of the abdomen. Instead, perform back slaps and chest thrusts to try to clear a severe airway obstruction in a responsive infant as follows. 1. Hold the infant face down, with the body resting on your forearm. Support the infant's jaw and face with your hand and keep the head lower than the rest of the body. 2. Deliver 5 back slaps between the shoulder blades using the heel of your hand. 3. Place your free hand behind the infant's head and back and turn the infant face up on your other forearm and thigh, sandwiching the infant's body between your two hands and arms. the infant's head should remain below the level of the body. 4. Give 5 quick chest thrusts in the same location and manner as chest compressions, using 2 fingers placed on the lower half of the sternum. For larger infants, or if you have small hands, you can perform this step by placing the infant in your lap and turning the infant's whole body as a unit between back slaps and chest thrusts. 5. Check the airway. If you can see the foreign body, then remove it. If not, then repeat the cycle as often as necessary. 6. If the infant becomes unresponsive, then begin CPR and follow the same sequence as for a child and adult. Unresponsive infants. If the infant becomes unresponsive during your attempts to relieve an airway obstruction, then perform CPR starting with chest compressions. Do not check for a pulse before starting compressions. Open the airway and look in the mouth. If you see an object that can easily be removed, then remove it with your finger and attempt to ventilate. If you do not see an object, then resume chest compressions. Continue the sequence of chest compressions, opening the airway, and looking inside the mouth until the obstruction is relieved or ALS providers take over. Special resuscitation circumstances. Opioid overdose. An opioid is a narcotic drug that, when taken in excess, depresses the central nervous system and causes respiratory arrest followed by cardiac arrest. Examples of opioids include heroin and oxycodone. In situations where opioid overdose is the suspected cause of a patient's cardiac arrest, bystanders may have administered the antidote naloxone, or Narcan, to the patient prior to EMS arrival. Naloxone blocks opiate receptors in the body and reverses the effect of opioid overdose. Naloxone auto-injector devices, intended for use by laypeople, as well as healthcare providers, are now available in the United States. If you respond to a patient who has possibly overdosed on an opioid and naloxone was administered by a bystander prior to your arrival, then determine how much of the medication was given and the route by which it was given. Your EMS medical director may implement a protocol that allows BLS providers to administer naloxone in cases of suspected opioid overdose. The recommended algorithm for implementing naloxone into the cardiac arrest management sequence is discussed in Chapter 21, Toxicology. Standard resuscitative measures, that is, high-quality chest compressions, ventilation, defibrillation, take priority over naloxone administration. Do not delay other interventions while awaiting the patient's response to naloxone therapy. Many patients who have overdosed on an opioid have a pulse, although slow, but are not breathing. In these patients, BVM ventilation is the most critical treatment, followed by administration of naloxone if it is available. Cardiac arrest in pregnancy. If you encounter a pregnant patient who is in cardiac arrest, then your priorities are to provide high-quality CPR and relieve pressure off the aorta and vena cava. When the patient lies supine, the pregnant uterus can compress the aorta and vena cava, which is referred to as aorta-caval compression. Compression of the vena cava causes a significant decrease in blood return to the heart and, secondarily, in the forward flow of blood to the vital organs. If the pregnant patient is not in cardiac arrest, then position her on her left side to relieve pressure on the great vessels. However, if she is in cardiac arrest, then this approach is impractical, because she must remain in a supine position to maximize the effectiveness of compressions. Therefore, if the top of the patient's uterus or fundus can be felt at or above the level of the umbilicus, perform manual displacement of the uterus to the patient's left to relieve aorta-caval compression while CPR is being performed. This step will improve the effectiveness of compressions. Brief support for family members and loved ones. Whenever you assist a patient, remember his or her loved ones may also be affected by the emergency. Serious illness, injury, and pediatric patients create an especially high level of anxiety for family members. A health emergency is often hard for family members to understand. In some cases, family members may experience a psychological crisis that turns into a medical crisis and may become patients themselves. Consider the scenario of a cardiac arrest in an otherwise healthy 57-year-old man. The family is watching your team perform CPR. They may assume you will bring him back or, at the very least, will expect you to transport. After 30 minutes or so, you stop resuscitation and start packing your gear, then turn the scene over to the police. The patient is lying dead on the floor. A trend in cardiac arrest care is to stay on the scene and perform the entire resuscitation in the location where the patient was found, particularly when ALS care is provided at the scene. Many EMS systems advocate this practice because continuous compressions are an important part of an effective resuscitation effort. CPR in the back of an ambulance is generally not as effective. If the patient has not responded to treatment after 20 to 30 minutes or longer, then many protocols suggest discontinuing resuscitative efforts and not transporting. However, this may create an uncomfortable situation at the scene. For EMS crews, wanting to help but not knowing what to do can be very stressful. Is it the responsibility of EMS to explain the death to the family? Would you consider the bereaved widow the legal or moral responsibility of EMS? How is good customer care defined here? If you consider a spouse and perhaps other family members to be your patients as well, then it is appropriate to interact with them. Using the above scenario as an example, consider the following things that may make grief support in the field a little easier. Whereas this cardiac arrest may be one of many similar calls in your career, family members and loved ones will remember this event in detail for the rest of their lives. Your reaction to them will form a lasting impression. Conversely, a mismanaged death notification or poor interaction could leave the family feeling disrespected or ignored. A compassionate and sensitive approach will leave a positive impression of you and your agency. Most important, appropriate and supportive care at the onset of grief may positively affect the family's grieving process. Families do not typically expect EMS providers to stop resuscitation and leave their loved one on scene. When death appears imminent and resuscitative efforts are unsuccessful, make the family members aware the patient is not responding to treatment. Discuss with them what is happening so they may be better prepared for the inevitable. Keep the family informed throughout the resuscitation process because it may also help them feel more in control. Sequential notification starts during resuscitative efforts. Family members should be updated as the resuscitation progresses, if possible. Designate one provider to communicate the patient's status to family members so that information is streamlined from one source rather than from multiple providers. Be concise and clear. For example, say, "Your husband is not breathing and his heart has stopped. We are attempting to restart his heart with the AED." After resuscitation efforts have stopped, it is appropriate to tell them, "As you know, when we arrived, your husband wasn't breathing and did not have a pulse. He has not responded to any of our treatments. I'm sorry, but he has died." Avoid euphemisms such as "passed away" or "passed on," because these expressions may be confusing or misinterpreted. Law enforcement personnel may be involved in the official death declaration and will likely be responsible for what happens next, such as determining whether the medical examiner should be notified. In a situation where ROSC occurs prior to transport, family members may wish to interact with the patient. This can give them comfort, especially if the patient ultimately does not survive. After resuscitation has stopped, these other measures can be helpful. Take the family to a quiet, private place. Introduce yourself and anyone with you. Use clear language and speak in a warm, sensitive, and caring manner. Try to exhibit calm, reassuring authority. Use the patient's name. Use eye contact and appropriate touch. Expect that family members will show emotion as they begin the grieving process. Be prepared for different reactions, including anger. While you are still on scene, be supportive but do not hover. Ask if a friend or family member can be called to come and help support them. When you need to leave, turn the family over to someone else, for example, a police officer. Some family members will want to see the deceased. Being able to touch or talk to their loved one may be helpful to them. This may not be advisable in a medical examiner's case. Law enforcement personnel will need to make that determination. It is appropriate to make the body presentable, but follow local protocols regarding movement of the patient or removal of resuscitation equipment. Another consideration is to ensure that children are not ignored. They may not understand death. Preschool-aged children may be less affected, whereas older children understand death but do not expect it to happen to someone they know. Younger children tend to blame themselves. Teenagers may be highly affected but may mask their feelings. It is never easy to be the bearer of bad news, but it can help to know you did your best for the family during a difficult situation. Lastly, consider your own feelings in this stressful situation and make sure you seek assistance if needed. See Chapter 2, Workforce Safety and Wellness, for a discussion of the emotional aspects of emergency care and stress management. Education and training for the EMT. You may go weeks or months without performing CPR on a human, depending on how busy your EMS system is. Like any skill, CPR skills can deteriorate over time. You must practice them often using mannequin-based training, ideally more frequently than the standard retraining that occurs every 2 years. The use of high-fidelity mannequins for CPR training is encouraged if your system's budget allows. If this is not an option, then CPR devices that provide corrective feedback are preferred over devices that only provide voice prompts, that is, a metronome. CPR self-instruction through video and/or computer-based modules with hands-on practice may be a reasonable alternative to instructor-led courses because it may facilitate frequent retraining. Education and training for the public. As an EMT, you are a patient advocate. Not only are you responsible for providing the best possible care for your patient, but you must also do your part to facilitate the training of laypeople in the critical skills of CPR and AED operation. Training in CPR and AED usage should not be limited to healthcare providers. Not enough laypeople are trained to perform these life-saving skills. Ask yourself, who is the real first responder? Obviously, the layperson is likely to be at the scene before you and your team arrive. As discussed previously, many laypeople assume CPR requires both mouth-to-mouth rescue breathing and chest compressions. As long as this misconception remains, fewer people will be wanting to help during an emergency, which means that fewer lives will be saved. If you are asked to train members of your community how to perform compression-only CPR, then you should consider it your professional responsibility and be willing to assist. It is likely that some citizens in your service area are at increased risk for cardiac arrest. Your agency should make an effort to identify these potential patients and educate their families to recognize cardiac arrest and to train them to perform compression-only CPR.